Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. I have the pleasure of speaking with today Dr. Deepa Dandekar on her fascinating translation on her book, The Subhedar's Son, a narrative of Brahmin-Christian conversion from 19th century Maharashtra. Welcome to the program, Deepa.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
It was brought to my attention by our last guest, Hamsa Stainton, that his book was part of the American Academy of Religion, Religion and Translation series. And if I'm not mistaken, so is this book, is it not?
Yeah. I went through the, So that was quite a breakthrough for me, actually, to go through that. And I felt really encouraged by the whole AAR series for translation. And that I thought that's the right place, you know, and it worked well for me.
Well, it's certainly great real estate, you know. It's good. It's I think the series what would happen either way, but the series I think tend to get more eyeballs on the publications because they're advertised throughout the AR, so that's great. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
This is a different kind of work than we normally do monographs. We have of course done a translation, a poetic translation. This is a translation of a story, is it not?
Yes. So, would you like me to say something about it right here or
they're different approaches. I think maybe the first approach is maybe you can tell us a little bit about the genesis of this, how this came up for you. You know, you talk about this in your preface. How did this project come about for you?
So, I think there are two levels at which I entered this project. The first was, of course, the academic interest about writing about a community of converts that couldn't be placed either within the Christian group, in the 19th century. They couldn't be placed within the Christian group because that group was always considered to be Europeans, European missionaries in India. And they couldn't really be placed within the Hindu group because most of them were converts from Hinduism and upper castes. So they couldn't be really placed there either because they were intensely ostracized from their families and communities and so on. So it's a kind of interstitial group that developed and grew quite powerful in the 19th and early 20th century. And not much is known about converts and not much is known about the kind of intellectual discourse and ferment that the community generated mostly in the vernacular, in Marathi. So I was fascinated with this for a long time. The actual catalyst is, of course, my family background, because I do belong to one such convert family on one side of my family line. And so I always knew that these books were there. I always knew these writings were there. And I never could lay my hands on it. It was at the British Library, at the Asia and Africa Collection Center, that I really started coming across this literature, which was carefully archived and And I followed an entire archival trail connected to these missions and vernacular materials and books, which isn't so available, so much in the limelight, or it isn't even really available in India. And it wasn't available in my own family. So we forgot the past because it somehow became considered, I don't know, maybe shameful is a strong word, but it became looked at in an odd manner that, oh, you're Christian, but how are you still Marathi? How are you still from the upper castes? Or how does this real interstitial position really work out for you in the post-colonial setting? So this was always difficult, and this led this kind of political environment sort of led to an erasure, if I may say. These are very strong words, but it led to a sort of pushing under the carpet. Oh, we don't look at that anymore. Yeah, that was all the past. That was all the 19th century, and it doesn't really matter to us anymore. And I felt that a whole world opened to me after I started looking at the archival material and the huge plethora of books and stories and poems and biographies and autobiographies and all sorts of polemic didactic material. So I think I approached it on these two different levels, which made sense. It clicked together. When John Nemec gave me the opportunity to sort of make the translation for the AR translation series, I leapt at it. It was very exciting for me.
Oh, it sounds like a fascinating cultivation of a personal interest in a scholarly way that sheds light on a very important epoch in Hindu history, if you will. Now I joke that I ended up writing on the Devi Mahatmya, and I ended up focusing on the frame of a king in exile. And I joke that I'm the Raj in exile in Toronto. So that must be why I'm fascinated with this frame story. But let's maybe first talk about what you've learned about the world behind the text before we dive into the world within the text. Does that sound fine with you? So what's happening? What's happening with these Brahmin Christian conversions? How are they coming about? How long are they lasting? Like, what can you tell us about that world?
After the Charter Act of 1830, missionary activities were no longer frowned upon in India. So most missionaries came at that time. In Maharashtra, the particular mission that I started working on was the Church Mission Society. Now, that was a very rural kind of a mission. It had its head office in Bombay, but then it went to areas like Nasik. Now, Nasik was important for them because it was a pilgrimage place. It was a place where a sort of sectoral Kumbh Mela takes place every 4 years or 5 years. And they wanted to open the mission there so that they could attract more Brahmins. The idea or the model of missionizing was convert the Brahmins and then the rest would follow. But this didn't really take off in the expected way because the Brahminical Society of Nasik really ostracized the converts. And so you actually have the Church Mission Society develop in a kind of a dual, there was a kind of a dual personality to the conversions that happened over there. So you had a Brahmin strata, and then you had the Adivasi strata. You had a lot of Gonds and Bhils and other lower caste members of the community there who joined the mission. So this developed into a kind of a specific thing because of the intense Brahminism of a city like Nasik. And this Nasik was also therefore a place where my great-grandfather's father converted to Christianity at the Church Mission Society. And my great-grandfather then wrote a book on his father's conversion. So it's a conversion narrative. And It's very much about the Hindu Brahmin background of the family and their imbrication in the politics of the Peshwai, and the Panipat War, and all sorts of different things that the family was involved with as part of the Peshwa administration and empire, the Maratha Empire, and how the fall of the Maratha Empire after 1818, after the Anglo-Maratha War, when the Peshwa was finally sent into exile, what this did to his administrators who were subedars, who were killedars, who had subas under them, or who had certain districts under them, who were administrators with little forts under them and small administrative duties like tax collection and sundry other things, keeping small armies. And they were suddenly disbanded, of course, after the fall of the Maratha Empire. And this led to a ruralization of these people who were esteemed sort of or considered esteemed at the courts and had high positions and had a kind of a nobility. And then suddenly they came to smaller cities and had to start again. And it was from this kind of a downfall that the book traces the emergence of conversion as a way in which Brahmins looked towards the future or looked towards opportunities, especially educational opportunities that would help them to study English and science and perhaps go to Bombay and Pune or start in some job, or where they would develop an individual identity of their own, which was no longer about being Brahmin or Peshwa background, but being individuals, being educated, reformist individuals who would look towards a more rational future, a more balanced future, and so on. So in a way, this whole idea of social reform, which in Bengal was, of course, very different with the Brahmo Samaj, and, of course, in Bombay also in the Prarthna Samaj and so on. This was very different from the kind of rural missions and the rural kind of background that many converts came, who looked at conversion not as reform, but who looked at conversion as a way of getting away from the past that had failed them, or the kind of Maratha Empire culture of you know, taking a sort of imperial life for granted. And that had failed them. And so it was a very different kind of a background to work with the documents of the Church Mission Society, which again in Maharashtra is very different from the Scottish Mission or from the American Mission. So those are different missions, and every mission has its own habitus, every mission has its own people, the way they interact, write stuff. And I came across my great-grandfather's book, which I always knew existed. It's called The Subedar's Son, because his grandfather was the Subedar, and the son, that was his own father, had converted to Christianity because he thought of wanting a new life. He planned about getting a new life for himself. He eloped with his wife because she wasn't allowed to join him after he converted, and he ran away with her, and they ran away to the mission, and they started from scratch. So it's it was startlingly modern in the rags to riches variety of experience that was documented in it. But what surprised me also was how intensely Brahmanical it was. How much it was about the Hindu past. And I wondered, my whole idea, of course, began just with interest. And I wondered later about how conversion is never really about what you convert to, but what you convert from and what you take with you, rather than something that is so entirely new that you can't begin to wrap your mind around it. You can't begin to be a Scotsman or an Englishman, and since you can't do that, what do? You just take what you have and make it into something individualistic. And
I'm really. Oh, that's fine. That's fine. There's a number of really, really fascinating threads in what you're sharing about the context behind this important piece of narrative. I muse in the back of my brain that there's sort of two kinds of trips or journeys in life, some that are a function of where you're trying to get, and then some that are a function of where you're trying to get away from. And you touch on this in your commentary of your book. I think we'll have more opportunity to dive into the world behind the text through the actual text. But first, could you tell us a little bit about the world in front of the text? And can you maybe unpack a bit about, what is the state of this legacy today? You know, can you say more about the inclination or the disinclination to pay attention or homage to such works or such, or this period of history? Could you say more about what's happening in front of the text?
Yeah, thank you for that. I mean, I think what I just briefly mentioned when we began our conversation was exactly how these narratives grew erased in the post-colonial period, and especially when the whole idea of what Marathi meant became reified to a Hindu identity. And there were questions like, oh, if you are a Christian, how can you be Marathi? And somehow there was a disjuncture that had become produced somehow discursively between the Christian identity and the Marathi identity. And so this is something, of course, my family also grew up with partially. My ancestors before me grew up with partially. And this was an aim for me. This was an aim for me to create diversity within the entire identity of being Marathi. There isn't one kind of Marathi. And there are different subjectivities and different identities that are part of the Marathi identity, which was so much part of the state formation of Maharashtra in 1960 with Balasaheb Thackeray and the Shiv Sena. And so it became really reified to that Hindu identity. And the question that arose, therefore, from the front of the book was, how can that pass? Therefore, it's teleological in a way, because it's like saying, oh, but this is the present and the past must always be just about the present. And how could the past be something so entirely different? So there was a kind of a zero moment with the formation of Maharashtra, that everything from the past that was taken was only taken to support the present. So everything in the present that had a legacy in the past was what was picked up and celebrated as heritage and history. And what didn't really fit in, or what didn't really, or what was kind of a conundrum, got left out. And so, which is why erasure, these are strong words, but because nobody really deliberately erased anything, but it's discursive. It's about how a certain history doesn't figure in the idea of a community's linguistic, literary, intellectual heritage, because it's deemed as having betrayed it. Oh, you or they went to the colonial side, and so you're betrayers, which wasn't true. I mean, there was the native vernacular mission. That was a hugely vibrant and developing group of converts who wrote and preached in Marathi. And there was a very, very strong presence of the Marathi church, which of course declined as a religious minority after the emergence of Maharashtra. Those are Christians, and they mostly come from either Goa, which everybody knows in discourse, of course, that they were forced through inquisitions to convert, or then these are all people who come from really backward castes or Adivasis who took money to convert. So, utilitarian conversion as such. But Stories like The Subedar's Son really demonstrate that the utilitarian approach was very much there with Shankar Nana as well, the first convert who wanted to escape the past, who felt betrayed by the past having given him and his wife nothing of importance, of really going to the mission, interacting and working every day with so many different other castes, eating with them. This was a big thing at a time, to break your own caste, and eat with other people, work with other people, and look towards a future which is individualistic and no longer caste-based or empire-based, in terms of the empire that they were talking about was the Peshwa. So in that sense, I think what has been the focus for me is to actually bring this all out a little bit, to say that the Marathi identity is a far more religiously diverse identity. And this is something that's easily done, for example, for Urdu or Bangla. Sure, these are Muslim languages. They're considered Muslim languages, but Marathi is not considered one, or Tamil, or, you know. So it's this kind of dissonance that happens with state formations in the post-colonial period that selectively read into the past what becomes more relevant to identities today, political identities, social identities today. So this was important for me to bring out a different kind of history connected to the same Marathi identity, a different kind of religious history.
Well, certainly your work shines light on a fascinating strand during this period of history that's significant. Before we dive into the actual story, we just have maybe one last question. It's a question about agency. So with regards to this, the silencing or this occlusion or this marginalization, or with regards to the way in which this story in particular and the epoch behind it has fallen by the wayside, where would you say the agency of that occlusion lies? In institutions and leaders and people and the zeitgeist itself? Like, how, what is the process whereby you think that occurred?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, as far as I think it's a collective process of not really understanding. Okay, so let me rephrase this. I think it isn't really. It's the agency of the political field rather than the intellectual field. So people who had converted out of an intellectual drive to read different texts, to learn and study and do other things, this drive itself became occluded. So it became more important to politically and socially identify with the community and an electorate and the formation of state and federalism and so on. I mean, the political identity took precedence in the sort of post-colonial period, where this drive itself of coming into a political self, coming into a Marathi federal self with a political party and an electorate, this itself was a force that served to occlude intellectual movements, where people did things because they thought that this would be a way to live. So in a sense, there was a certain change in culture rather than, so of course there were institutions as well. I mean, missionary institutions carried on. They carried on, but the culture of really thinking for yourself and reading for yourself and deciding for yourself, this kind of a 19th century drive of reform came to an, I think this is something that was occluded, because what happened after that was to identify with something rather than think for oneself. So there was a resurgence of community identity, and the Marathi identity became really, really strong Rati, as I was reading Oliver Godsmark's really wonderful book on how, the Marathi, the demand for Maharashtra could actually be compared with the demand for Pakistan. It was a federal movement. It was a movement for a different electorate. It was a different kind of political upheaval, the Sanyukta Maharashtra Andolan that was at the back of it. So this became a kind of political project, which really didn't leave much scope for people who had intellectually engaged with different religious scriptures, different texts, different traditions and thought and decided for themselves. So I think it was the zeitgeist, it's also a change and it's also a shift in political culture. I think that's exactly where the occlusion took place, if I were to say
yes,
it that
thank
way.
You. Thank you for indulging my question. So, Tipra, what is a Subedar and what is the story of this Subedar's son?
Yeah. So the story is, the book is largely, though not consciously, but it's largely divided into two parts. And of course, the author whose name was Dinkar Shankar Savarkar, he was my great-grandfather, and he wrote from the perspective of being a Christian. So that's the first thing that should be said. And his agenda of writing about the Hindu past from a Christian perspective is something that already reinvents a kind of Hinduism for the reading public of that time, especially those who bought vernacular books and who read books on change and reform and women's position in society and religion and modernity and so on. So there was a kind of a vernacular movement, a boom in texts which were written much more spontaneously, which were not premeditated texts or ritual texts or very intensely collectively composed by a group of people. These were texts which were spontaneously written by kind of, let's say, avant-garde writers and thinkers. And the book is divided, therefore, roughly into two parts. The first part is really about, he starts talking about the convert's father and how he was in the Battle of Panipat. The book starts with Panipat. It starts with the fall of the Peshwas. It starts with the entire identity of being a part of the Peshwas retinue, being part of the entire Maratha sort of background, the Maratha Empire background, and what goes on to describe how this ancestor was a Subedar, and he was in charge of a large fort. And finally, when the British took over all the forts, he was asked to abdicate, and he did. And he then came to a smaller village near Nasik, and they lived there, and were, of course, he describes how the Subedar goes through a lot of depression and sadness at what he had thought would come of his life and for his children. And of course, everything was laid waste. And he dies after taking sannyas and really disappointed. And the younger son, having really no way forward, with his elder brother having assumed the whole property and all its working and whatever that there was to be done, the younger son kind of became a bit alone. He also suffered an accident. He broke his leg. The long and short of it is he had a lot of time to think about what his position in society and family was, or what he could really do in terms of the fact that his family had really lost out everything. And how would he really look for his own life? And Savarkar's way of talking about it is, of course, from the perspective of the soul. How would he save his soul? How would he really look towards God's path? And that would be his individual journey. So the first part of the book, which is intensely about this Brahmanical background and family, the second part of the book is more about the sort of emotional descriptions of the convert while engaging with the Christian scriptures for the first time, what it did to him, what he thought about it, what he thought about the world, what he thought about the nature of God, what he thought about family and respectability and education and the change that had taken place in society, especially rural society. Then towards the last quarter of the book, when the convert, proto-convert at that time, decides to convert, then starts growing into a story of ostracism, starts growing into a story of how he was repulsed by his elder brother, rejected, scolded, constantly evaluated for his thoughts. What books do you read? And you're going towards those Christians and those schools, and they will convert you, and they will, our family will be ruined, and you're taking all the purity away. And so then the last quarter of the book is about how harassed he felt for thinking differently. And finally, he defects to the mission, and they're very moving. Well, defection, no, he sort of takes the decision, and a lot of moving discussions about how he tells his family that he's going for a bath at the Godavari, at the river, and instead just leaves home, touches everything in the home for one last time, and touches his brother's feet and while they're sleeping. And with a towel on his shoulder and his mug, he's off and he goes to the mission directly, never comes back. And later he rescues, or he kidnaps his wife, who's also a small child. At that time, she was a child bride. I mean, his wife was about 30 years younger to him. And there's a lot of discussion at this point of time about how other Hindus, his other friends at that time, look at him saying, oh, now you've become a Christian. You could go to Bombay. You could go to the Monet School there or the Wilson School there in Bombay. And there are lots of Anglo-Indian girls there. You leave this little child bride. How do you care? She's just a child. You don't even know her. So forget your first marriage, and you could really marry somebody who's smart and anglicized and maybe an Anglo-Indian girl or something. And you have lost your morality because you've become Christian. And there's a long sort of ruminations on just because we are Christian doesn't mean we are immoral. Just because we are Christian doesn't mean that we have lost all the social and linguistic and cultural moorings that we grew up with. And he has, well, with a friend, he goes in the night and his wife is playing outside the house, and he kidnaps her and he brings her to the mission, where she's brought up in the orphanage for the next 10 years before she becomes an adult and is later remarried to him again in the church after she converts. So after reading the book, I mean, I had a feeling this was, of course, it's written from the convert's perspective. It's written from the Christian's perspective. And I felt dissatisfied with the single view. I felt I was losing the convert in it. It was so much his son who was writing about his father and his ancestors and Panipat and whatnot, that I felt that I needed to sort of juxtapose this a little bit to the convert's voice. And I discovered this huge, really tremendous archival cache at the Cadbury's Research Center in Birmingham, where they have a huge number of archival material, daily logbooks, correspondence, reports, annual reports, letters from the Church Mission Society from Nasik. And I was able to, it was a wonderful moment where I could really locate him. He was a middle-level Marathi pastor in a local church in Malegaon, which is north of Nasik. And and I found his letters and I found his stuff, all his annual reports and his weekly reports and so on. And I was able to glimpse a little bit into the life of a normal convert who had his doubts in place, whereas the book that his son wrote was almost hagiographic. It was about, oh, my dad was this great, great man who converted and was so brave and who really saved his soul, and which was far much more theological from the Christian perspective. When I saw the convert's own documents, I realized that this was a life of considerable struggle, especially a lot of retribution from the family side. I mean, they called him over for food once and they poisoned his food because he had insulted them by converting. And a lot of family pain, a lot of family struggle, as well as a lot of racism from European missionaries who wouldn't let him grow, who wouldn't let him take up any senior position, who evaluated him constantly. And, well, his own descriptions of missionizing among the Bhils. He spoke the vernacular of the Bhils and the Gonds. He was one of the few missionaries of that time who traveled a lot in the Adivasi areas. And I couldn't find his own books. He's written books on Bhil, in Bhil, for Christian songs in the Bhil language. And it's published by the Bombay Tracts and Book Society, but I couldn't find it. I've looked high and low for it, but I haven't found it. So there was a lot of drive towards vernacular Christianity and Marathi and Bhil and those different local languages that were spoken in the Nasik and Pune region at that time and among the Christian community, which was converting, or new converts. So it sort of opened my eyes to an entire sort of history of vernacular Christianity, where all these people were not automatically European or sort of lackeys or, you know, or people who were part of the European mission. But the fact that they had changed the mission themselves. They had themselves displaced the Europeans in the mission by adding to this burgeoning kind of native convert presence and the vernacular writings of these native converts that Europeans had, well, I wouldn't say no access into, but peripheral access into. So though there are a lot of, there's a lot of correspondence by the end of the 1800s about so many converts and so many intellectual converts writing in the vernacular about religiosity, not just Hinduism, but also about a kind of a Christian bhakti consciousness that was very much about the convert's experience, which missionaries couldn't share. They weren't converts. I mean, European missionaries were not converts. And of course, they sort of beheld this intense experience of conversion, which turned the lives of converts in front of their eyes upside down, and they couldn't share in it. They could just watch it, and they doubted it at times, and they closely scrutinized the vernacular texts for any evidence of blasphemy or, you know, lapsing back into Hindu religiosity. But at the same time, there was this huge consciousness suddenly of bhakti, of Krista bhakti, of Christian devotion. And this is something that was in itself an independent kind of religiosity that was divorced from European missionaries on the one hand, and of course, from Hindu ostracism on the other, because Hindus or many family members at that time felt that this was not religion, this was breaking religion. Conversion was very, very tabooed in the 19th century. It still is. And but that time, especially in upper caste families who were looked upon as upholders of dharma, conversion was viewed as a direct deviation from family and status. So many of these converts, like my great-grandfather's father, of course, they lost status. They lost property, they lost status, they the kind of background that many people who continued with the same trajectory or the legacy of the Peshwai, they didn't lose the same things. These people lost something different. I mean, most importantly, I think, I look back and I think the most important thing is the genealogy that they lost, the Vanshavali. Everybody had a Vanshavali. These people were cut off from the family's Vanshavali. So they lost that social mooring, which was so important among upper caste families. And they made their own moorings. They made their own moorings among Christian families and, at that time, mostly upper caste Christian families that had converted in the same kind of intellectual, in the throes of the same kind of intellectual movements. So
Who would you say the audience of this book originally was?
I think the audience, I don't know whether, I think the audience is the liberal Marathi person today who would want to, know about the heritage of the Marathi identity, which is, or the vernacular identity, which is not just reduced to the Hindu identity. So, it's hard for me to, and of course, I mean, to the academic world, it's also, where there's very little, there's relatively little about this whole vernacular missions and vernacular converts and vernacular literature and poetry and writing. So there are a few names that have become very famous from Maharashtra, like Pandita Ramabai and Mukti Mission. They, feminist scholars really took up Mukti Mission and Ramabai at a point, especially since she was connected to the Brahmo kind of background in Bengal. But apart from Mukti and Ramabai, not much is known about this whole mission field. What is known is the contribution of individuals like Narayan Vaman Tilak or Nehemiah Gore, or Ananta Shastri Lele, or how should I say, Baba Padmanji. Oh, that was a doyen. He was a big man. So what is known is individuals. What isn't really understood is the historical context within which all these people were interconnected, their writings were interconnected, they intermarried among each other, so amongst each other's families. So one part of my family comes from the Mukti Mission. My great-grandmother was one of the orphans from Mukti Mission herself. So there is a certain kind of connectivity. So the mission field is not just a literature field like everybody reading each other's texts, but it's also a social field. And it's a part of history that I would hope academics who are interested in Marathi identity, and also in Hinduism, because all these people were converts from Hinduism, and they had an opinion and a kind of a worldview about Hinduism that they presented their audiences with when talking about what they were converting from and why. And these were also personal experiences of Hinduism, very similar to what you may find in the mid-20th century about Dalit experiences of Hinduism, which were unhappy, which were painful, which were descriptions and standpoint subject positions from which the new Buddhist identity took off. So in a sense, I think the audience would really, I would think, apart from an academic audience of historians who would really like to know about this sort of a third space that had developed between missions and colonial bureaucratic offices and, you know, in quotes, the natives. There was an interstitial intellectual community which intermarried, which had Marathi churches, which had printing presses, which had journals that came out quite regularly, like the Dhyanodaya. We know about the Prarthana Samaj kind of journals like Subodh Patrika or others, but we know very little about, at least I haven't seen a book on the Dhyanodaya as yet or any articles, but these were journals that came out really often, twice a month, with lots of little essays and write-ups in the vernacular from different converts. So this was a social field. And I was hoping to attract historians, historians who were interested in religion in the colonial period, was interested in scholars on Hinduism and Christianity, was interested in people in the Marathi identity who would want to know. I mean, I was interested in readers or interested, I'm interested in attracting readers to these topics. So I think that was my, yeah.
One of the themes you touch on that I think is very present in the narrative is the tension or juxtaposition between religion and, say, ethics, values, conduct. Would you say, without offering too leading a question, would you say that's the primary theme of the book? Would you say there's some other primary theme, objective, aim, purpose of the book as a literary work? What would you say, you know, how would you comment on that if you could?
I think this is a really interesting question, and I'm glad you phrased it this way, because I don't want to go as far as saying, conversion was like social reform, you know. Social reform in that time, you had Paramhans Mandali people and Prarthana Samaj members in Bombay, and the entire emphasis of these groups was about conduct. It was about it was also about social institutions like widow remarriage and women's education, and I think converts, what they did was they added the morality part to it. They added the whole idea about goodness, what's the right thing to do, rather than what's the social thing to do. So I think converts...
Virtue.
Sorry?
Something along the lines of virtue versus prescribed.
Yeah, bang on. So I think... in a sense, they interacted really closely with social reformists, and they went a step further. I mean, for many Christian converts, the passion and the zest with which Christianity was presented by them, for them, social reform would just bring in more social evils. I mean, okay, it's a bit complicated. They felt that Hinduism wasn't a religion, and it was a kind of falsehood, and reforming what was false would just regurgitate it and bring out more social evils. And for example, Baba Padmanji, whom I'm writing a book on currently, he says exactly this. I mean, he is somebody who supports Ishwar Chandra Vidyasagar in this whole widow remarriage act, but then, which was passed in 1856, but then he points to the nature of the first widow remarriages that took place in Bengal immediately after the act was passed. And both the child widowed brides, in both these widowed brides in these cases were children. One was 9 and the other, I think, was 11. So the whole idea of Christianity, of man and woman being equal, being able to love each other, find a reflection of godliness between each other, was anyways defeated with the kind of widow remarriages that were taking place. Because these girls, the same criteria about these girls being children existed. It went further. It was just that they had been widowed because they were married to men who were 80 years old or they had never seen their husbands. So that was the technical change was the only change that took place. And he supported that because it brought in a huge number of widows into the fray of remarriage, but it didn't do away with the original harm of child marriage. And they had to wait for the Age of Consent Bill, and that had its own history. But the Christian perspective to social reform was that social reform, while remaining Hindu, was an eyewash because it just kept regurgitating the same old problems. Whereas Christianity, implicit within it was the whole idea of intellectually, emotionally being an individual and relating to your spouse as an individual and knowing what made her happy and being equal in front of God. So it was a social reform intervention, but it was about virtue. It was about going that one step further. So I think in that sense, it was a radical move to convert, and to convert as part of a sort of an intellectual ferment that, of course, had the cultural capital of being Western educated and going to all these different mission schools and learning different subjects. So, of course, it was embedded in that kind of cultural capital that you were educated. But at the same time, it was about becoming really modern, and not becoming modern in the social reform way that allowed you to remain Hindu and Brahmin, and, you know, the eyewash of widow remarriage, where actually the widows were still children who had no way of influencing the emotional worth of their marital life, which was what Christian reformists were talking about. So Savarkar, when he talks about his own father's conversion and the fact that his father ran away or kidnapped his child wife, goes into significant detail about how she remained for 12, 13 years with the missionaries in the orphanage, in the girls' orphanage in Nasik, and only then was she remarried by, I read the church bans about their marriage when she was about 16. So there was a great emphasis on this whole thing of individuality, that he was concerned about her happiness. He was concerned about what she thought. So I think this was a kind of social reformism, and as yet went one step further to say real social reform comes by, which is something I think which Ambedkar did 100 years later, but in a different direction, that by leaving Hinduism is the only way of really becoming reformed. Well, that's debatable, but that was what... That was the idea behind it all, I think, at that time.
So when we're looking at this story written by Savarkar, I think in 1895, is this primarily a window into his time, into his father's time, the time of the conversion in which the story is set, or is it a window into his mental, emotional, social, familial state?
Such cool questions. Yeah. I mean, I think it lies somewhere in the middle. It lies because all I found of Shankar Nana's autobiographical writings, I mean, the convert's autobiographical writings, was his Christian witness. And that was in 1882 or 1881. And I found that in the archives, and that's all I have by him about his life. The rest of the book was built up on the basis of conversations, family traditions, and very interestingly, when his son, Dinkar Shankar Savarkar, wrote the book, he borrowed a huge amount of the text from, which I later came to understand, from Baba Padmanji's autobiography called Arunodaya. Now, that was another very big Christian convert in 19th century Maharashtra. And I see how much he has borrowed. And so I argue about a domain of literary presence at a point of time among Christians, which became an archive. So a convert's past became a public archive for the community. Not every convert could really talk about his archive in the same ways we would imagine people speaking in therapeutic sessions today. How do you really feel? What did that make you feel? So I don't think that was really there. What was there was this entire corpus of literature where others were writing individual stories of their past. And this was like an archive that... that other converts, second generation converts, writing about their parents and writing about their parents' experiences of conversion, really sort of brought forward again and again in order to make a consolidated vernacular front of convert convert experiences. So the window in this case, if I hadn't found Shankar Nana's private materials in the Birmingham archive, I wouldn't really know, or I wouldn't really be able to juxtapose it in the same way. So that I somehow was able to do for this book, which was really lucky for me. But it's between Shankar Nana, it's between his son Dinkar Shankar Savarkar, it's between Savarkar and the rest of the Christian community and their literature that he borrowed. To a certain extent, it's also with me because I translated it. So I had to think quite a lot about what does this translation really mean for me? Apart from the fact that it was really exciting material that I saw for the first time that I'd only heard of from my mother. Yeah, your great-grandfather wrote that book about his dad, and we don't have it in the family anymore. We don't know where it went. Maybe it got lost. Maybe it's not important. Maybe no one wants to know about us. Maybe they all think we are dirty and bad people for having converted. Maybe we are betrayers. We were harassed. We were teased. And the entire kind of occlusion that takes place for religious minorities. It was really interesting and really exciting for me to sit in London, sit in Birmingham, really touch those materials. And a large amount of that retrieval lies with me today. And I don't know exactly where I would place myself vis-a-vis the current community, vis-a-vis Dinkar Shankar Savarkar, whom I never saw. Naturally. And his community and his dad and the rural Nasik Brahmanical outpost of Nasik. So it's really interstitial. There's a genealogy, there's a thread that runs through it. There's a family narrative that was there for me as well, because I knew of these books and what they said before really reading them and realizing that they just said half of what the family thought they said, but they said other stuff too, which had been left out in the kind of Chinese whispers, going from year to year, generation to generation, things that had gotten lost, left behind. So apart from the personal excitement that always accompanies unearthing new archival material and material that people don't really know much about, the window is really rather collective. It's about this whole social field and bringing it to Marathi identity as a part of its diversity, as a part of its richness, as a part of its literary history, its heritage. So,
there's so many, many, many layers of insight to be gleaned by looking at this work. I mean, all kinds of questions come up. The extent to which it's descriptive versus prescriptive, the extent to which this is affording insight into your great-grandfather's circumstance or his concerns or the time of his father. And I have to say, there's something very Mahabharata about you partaking in this narrative about your great-grandfather's generation, which itself recounts, you know, the time of Vyasa, you know, like there's something epic about this.
And, it is, isn't it? Yes. The first time I saw those letters, Raja had goose pimples. It was a very, very overwhelming experience for me to touch those words. I mean, it was very embodied, and I can't really, you know, I can't really, on the one hand, the entire heroism of it, oh, he was this great guy and who broke all the rules and converted, and on the other hand, oh, he was this impure bigot who broke society and broke family and was a shame. You know, these are the binaries. These are the binaries that I couldn't relate to. What I could really think about, which I still struggle with, that what really made him take that step. And looking back as part of this Mahabharata, or looking back at it from this genealogical kind of perspective, I must accept we can't understand everything about the past. I mean, however much, or I can't, maybe others do. And that would be great to know what others bring up in terms of other vernacular narratives and translations and research. But I don't think today that I can really touch it. I can see it. I can see those words. I can touch those words. But what really made him go that extra mile? I don't know. So in a way, it's this mysterious thing about religious transformation. It's this mysterious kind of event and process which is written and rewritten and copied between other books. And yet it remains occluded in a way because one doesn't really know what lies behind the words. It's said that way because it was printed. It was meant to be read that way. It was meant to inform readers of modern Bombay about religious change and transformation and true nature of reform. And yet there's something deeply personal about conversion that's about biography. And so I think the methodology for understanding conversion narratives for me, as far as I would say, would be translation, would be understanding biographical writings. As far as one could translate these in a larger cultural sense to come as close as possible to where every convert really made that change or took that leap forward or so, you know? So it's in a way, it's quite mysterious. And it's since I've been a kid, I've been tickled by it a little bit. You know, there's this huge fireside story about, you know, he really felt that his life changed at that moment. And me thinking, yeah, I can't even change my mind about who my best friend is currently. How did he change his mind about religion? You know, that feeling of mystery, that feeling of change that is just documented, but can't be felt because it's too big.
Well, these most fascinating projects, most fascinating narratives, complexes in history or in personality, the most fascinating things we study are the least tidy, the least avail themselves to ready explication, but therein lies their allure, right? It's complex and it's multivalent, and there's so much going on there that it needs to be studied.
Yeah, it's a palimpsest. There are layers and layers, and every time you unearth something, you feel, oh wait, there's something written underneath this. Yeah,
such I think is the penchant of narrative to purposely preserve tensions and paradoxes. It refuses to design, right? It refuses to give you a simple linear answer, and I think that is why narrative is a powerful form, and that's why. Your great grandfather, to do what he wanted to do, he had to choose narrative. We're taking enough of your time for today. It's been but an hour and change. But the last thing that comes to mind, I'll just say before we close, is, you know, this religion, quote unquote, religion in translation series. The books in this series, they're offering literal translations. But it's this bigger project, right? It's this bigger project of understanding conversion, understanding biography, hagiography, religious narratives, ethics, values. It's translating phenomenon of religion for people who don't study it. I think it's really... it's an apt home for this kind of project.
Yeah, I felt so too. I mean, I initially wrote to Anne Monius about it, and she passed my proposal on to John Nemec. And I felt intensely encouraged by him and the series. And it was really good. It was a really, it was apt, as you say. It's really found its home, in a sense, a translation like this. Yeah.
Great. For those of you listening, we have been speaking with Deepa Dandekar on her 2019 OUP publication, The Kumbhedar Son. Thank you very much for being on the program.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I've had fun. Thank you.